The election might be over, but there's a lot of work ahead for the Democratic Party, and the soul-searching continues about where the party's attention needs to be right now.
I told President-elect Biden the last time he was here in Detroit, I may not be going to be your favorite member of Congress, but I want you to know we have the same goals. I'm just on a different timeline. I have to move quicker because I have the third poorest congressional district in the country.
Rashida Tlaib just got reelected to her second term in Congress, representing Michigan's 13th congressional district. She's packed a lifetime into those 2 years. This is the Stateside Podcast. I'm April Baer. Congresswoman Tlaib is part of a vibrant class of incoming freshman Dems elected in 2018 who helped to shape politics during a critical election cycle. She's now trying to meet the needs of her district during a pandemic and subsequent economic slide that erased many of the gains of the last decade.
I have mothers that can't afford water. I have school districts that had to close down their water fountains because it's contaminated with lead. I have neighbors that are dying of cancer because they're surrounded by corporate polluters that are not held accountable. We all want the same thing. And it's not left or right, it's just justice. My residents can't afford to wait another hour, another day, another month, another year for meaningful change.
If there is anyone in a position to remind Washington and the incoming Biden administration about the needs of Metro Detroit voters and their importance to his victory, it'd be Rashida Tlaib. Congresswoman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, I wanted to ask you right out of the gate how your constituents are doing in light of the recent surge of COVID cases. What are you hearing from folks on your staff who do constituent services?
I mean, I think my whole staff and I have been triaging so much emergencies that have been coming in from those that can't get access to unemployment to having a family member die of COVID and not being able to afford funeral cost to family members trying to figure out what to do about lack of access to, you know, internet for their children and trying to connect them to resources and folks at the school district. And, you know, many of my neighbors were already in survivor mode before this pandemic. Much of their lives were not, they didn't access these kinds of opportunities you see other folks easily accessible to. And so I know for many of them, the pandemic hit them the hardest. I mean, these are frontline workers. Many of my folks, again, were living check by check. And so the economic divide was very clear as soon as the pandemic hit our district. And, you know, a lot of them have a lot of anxiety and fear right now. But it is the day-to-day challenges that comes with this pandemic that never gets to be talked about publicly. You hear about folks getting COVID positive tests and you hear about folks losing members, but the impact on the actual family from losing the primary breadwinner or losing the person that was the backbone of the family and the fact that they weren't even able to be there when they lost their loved ones or be able to give them a proper burial or a funeral because of, you know, the fear of COVID spreading throughout the family. I mean, it's just those kinds of day-to-day challenges and difficulty for our families is so clear in the 13th district.
Yeah. I mean, it's anybody's guess right now whether there's going to be meaningful legislation passed by both the House and the Senate before the end of the year. But what is on your mind about top line concerns and things that Congress could do?
Congress can put the people first and make government work for the people during a pandemic. It's no fault of their own that we're dealing with a pandemic and is our responsibility and duty. I mean, right now, you see the lack of urgency on the part of Congress and the part of the United States Senate. We passed a HEROES Act. Let's negotiate and talk about a stimulus payment. Let's talk about extending unemployment benefits. Let's discuss expanding testing and tracing. Let's talk about the fact that our school districts have very little resources right now to provide a safe environment for our children to learn. And much of this discussion hasn't, again, moved in the timeline that I think is really critically important for many of our residents across this nation. We failed them already. We're months and months behind in providing support and making sure that we have their back during this pandemic. And I'm increasingly so distressed by it. You know, when it's corporations and airlines, we move with the speed of light. When it's to confirm you know, Supreme Court justice nominees, we move with the speed of light. But when it's to save lives, it's to save people from losing their homes, to make sure their children don't get sick going to school, all of that should have equal priority, but it doesn't.
President-elect Biden made it clear late in the final days of the campaign that he was well aware of voters in Detroit. And in his speech a week ago Saturday night, he certainly seemed aware of Black voters who he said always had his back and he would be there for them, he said. What did you interpret that to mean?
I mean, I'm not sure other than to say that he recognized the importance of my Black neighbors who have historically shown up for our country, shown up for each other, shown up for communities. I know that my neighbors had to walk past schools that closed down, communities that have been stricken from blight, polluted air. They had to pass by so much decay and so much poverty to vote for President-elect Biden. And they did that, even though some feel like, when is it going to change? When are we going to see meaningful change that betters their life? And, you know, during this uprising, if anything, there's been this new kind of awakening. It's always been there, but now it's so real for many people as they see people marching in the streets, demanding the right to breathe, demanding the right to live. And I think in much of what he's saying in that, I'm hoping, is going to result in that meaningful action. The fact that he's going to realize and understand that much of the policies in place and much of how it's implemented is structurally racist, that we need to push back against communities like mine that get left behind. When you talk about clean water, you talk about access to economic stability, to home ownership, to so many of these very important measures that, you know, fight back against folks not being able to be able, you know, to thrive in our country. I think it's really critically important.
There's so much in flux with the transition right now. Do you feel like you have the Biden operation's attention if you need it?
I think the residents have his attention. I think my district has his attention. Right now, as the results come in across our nation, when you see, you know, the Latino community, the African-American community, the marginalized communities, you know, came forward and said, you are our possibility. You are going to create the door to that possibility of a better life. I think he's paying attention to that. And I think that's why some of his speech included recognizing and seeing that needs to be center in his administration as it comes forward.
In a moment, we'll continue my conversation with Rashida Tlaib and get more of her thoughts about where the Democratic Party is headed. Support for the Stateside podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu. We're talking today with Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat, born and raised in Detroit and the proud daughter of Palestinian immigrant parents. She's built her political identity on representing a racially diverse district and putting her constituents' needs in the forefront. Sometimes that's meant striking a different tone than House leaders or reps from swing districts may take. We know from several news sources that some of the incoming freshmen in the Democratic Party have been unloading on progressives pretty heavily, saying they shouldn't talk about police reform right now. They shouldn't talk about anything that might be cast by Republicans as socialist or outside the mainstream. One of the quotes was, "Don't say defund the police when that's not what we mean." When someone like Representative Abigail Spanberger says that, what do you hear?
Well, I think, you know, for many of us that support the uprising, the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, for us, when people talk about defund police, that's code for the Black Lives Matter movement that is saying we need to invest in communities and schools first and stop investing in criminalization and militarization of our police. I really continue to see more of my poor residents being criminalized. instead of being uplifted and being supported, even though they're working one or two or three jobs. And for many of my colleagues, I ask them to please focus on your district. Don't focus on me representing mine. Focus on your district and what their needs are. Because if you focus on that, you will thrive. Instead of focusing on what I'm trying to do in my predominantly Black district, and a district, again, where my working class residents have to call me and say they can't afford their medicine for their diabetes, or they can't even afford the funeral costs for their family member that died of COVID. I have to represent my district and speak up. And when you try to do that, you're trying to silence my residents when you tell me not to say certain things or talk about or advocate for, again, these meaningful actions and changes that need to happen. If folks really do center on their district, then they wouldn't have to worry about what my district is trying to do.
So this conversation about which way the Democratic Party should lean, more toward mainstream, more toward moderates, or more progressive, I mean, Donald Trump got a million more votes this election than he did in 2016. That's not really the 13th district's problem. But if it were, if you were in charge of the DCCC, what do you think should be done about that?
I mean, look, I believe truly that you have to bring your district with you to Washington, D.C. Absolutely do that. But you can do that without silencing districts like mine. I think people want to see that you care about them, that you care enough to be so centered on their needs and what they're going through. And if I was even remotely, even in leadership at the DCCC, I would have measurable goals of, you know, what are you doing in your district to making sure that you are staying connected, communicating? There's so many measurable goals when it comes to fundraising, but are we having measurable goals of what constituent services we're offering, how we're connecting to our residents? Are you sending out the newsletters and letting them know what's going on with COVID? Are you providing them locations for free testing? Are you educating them on what their rights are if they cannot afford to pay their mortgage during COVID? Residents want to see you fight for them and care for them. And I have seen many of my colleagues, particularly here, even in Michigan, that won their district and actually did much better than President Trump, much better than even President-elect Biden. They were able to be successful because I truly believe they centered their work in Washington, D.C. on their needs, not on what everybody else is doing, what not one Speaker Pelosi is doing, but they made sure they were so laser focused on the needs of their district that it translated to the residents. Yes, I got the advocate I need in Congress. I got the person that actually sees and hears us. And I think that's what people want to see mostly, not Democrat, Republican, but that you have their backs.
Well, at the same time, you've got people like Haley Stevens in the 11th district who gave a uniquely passionate and uniquely personal floor speech about COVID that went viral and was capitalized on by Republicans. She barely got reelected by about 10,000 votes this year.
Yeah. And, you know, this is something that I know Haley deeply cares about her district, and she works so extremely hard. I love that Representative Stevens is recognizing and allowing herself at this moment to say, you know, I'm going to work harder, that she's inspired. She knows that she needs to do more in regards to reaching out to those communities. She's like, wow, I need to reach out to some of these communities that might be aware of all the things that I've been doing, because she has been a leader on the manufacturing industry and supporting them during this. She has been a leader in being the president of the freshman class and bringing us together, all different political spectrums together. She's done a phenomenal job. And I wonder how many of her residents know that she's been doing that kind of work.
Getting back to the incoming Biden administration for a minute, what exactly has Biden committed to with respect to police reform and Black Lives Matter? And what do you hope may be in the offing?
Well, I hope that transformative change is going to happen. And I know it's going to happen because of the uprising, the movement work in the streets. It always happens from there. And it reaches the Oval Office. It reaches Congress. I say that because I never thought that we would get bipartisan support in the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act to get rid of a very, very, you know, dangerous immunity that we have for police officers. And I mean, we have Republicans.
Just for the layperson, qualified immunity is a concept that limits the liability that officers face when they're involved in use of deadly force. And I believe other kinds of force as well.
Absolutely. And it took away our way to hold them accountable for murdering people, for using lethal force on folks. And so qualified immunity was in the Justice and Policing Act that we named after George Floyd, and we were able to pass out of the House again with bipartisan support. But it was primarily because of the protests and the marches in the streets and the cries from Black mothers saying, you know, when George Floyd cried out for his mother, they were crying out for us, you know, crying for all of us, that he wanted to breathe, that he wanted to live. And so I just know that President-elect Biden is still going to be seeing these protests and marches and folks in Movement for Black Lives who are pushing for Breathe Act and other meaningful policy changes. That's not going to go away because he's elected. So he's going to have to make sure that he hears and sees that movement. And then how does he translate that into, you know, bipartisan support or support from the Senate and the House? Again, it wasn't because of something the Congress did. It was because folks in the streets demanded we get rid of qualified immunity, and it happened. And again, I don't think it would have happened but for the people demanding it.
Rashida Tlaib, we hope you get a few minutes of respite this week and this weekend. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, April.
And that's the Stateside Podcast for today. I'm April Baer. You can find the full Stateside show at michiganradio.org. You know, if you're enjoying our new sound, we'd love to have you subscribe. Also, could you please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, which helps other people find the show? The executive producer for Stateside is Laura Weber Davis. Today's episode was produced by our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our editor is Jen Guerra. Theme music is by 14KT. Additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. See you next time.